More resilient cities today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. When it comes to coping with huge storms like Harvey, this expert says Houston and other cities have to become more resilient.
So that the ground and the grass and your natural environments become the place where water naturally gets stored, as opposed to having it, again, channeled on concrete-paved streets where it can't drain anywhere.
Also, heavy rains in Mumbai this week make for a terrible commute.
I spoke to a lot of people who were actually on the streets for 8 or 9 hours and they couldn't reach home.
And a young Somali explains what it's like to listen to Somali music from the 1970s.
Imagine listening to Shakespeare. You wouldn't understand it the first time they sing it to you. You need to have it written down and analyze it.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World.
The sun is actually shining outside, but homes are continuing to flood.
That's Houston resident Will Bradley summing up the situation in his hometown today. He's been using his kayak to rescue people trapped by Tropical Storm Harvey.
People are tired. They're mentally drained, emotionally drained. People are just exhausted, but people continue to show up and help in droves, and it's been an amazing thing to see just the neighborhoods and the communities.
The storm has already caused catastrophic flooding, driving tens of thousands out of their homes. The city of Houston was among the hardest hit, and many are wondering whether it could have done more to prepare for the flooding. For more on this, we turn to Dale Morris. He works for the Dutch government, and part of his job is to advise U.S. cities on water management initiatives. The Netherlands is considered a global leader in that area. I asked Morris how he would advise Houston.
This is the third major flood in Houston in the last 3 years. So this condition is sort of becoming the new normal. And the way you deal with this is a way that Houston perhaps may need to change some of its practices. You need to zone better. You need to make sure people don't live in the floodplains, or if they do, that they have houses that are elevated and can withstand floods, that there are storage areas where you can store massive amounts of rainfall, where you can add additional pump capacity to help drain the land where that is, and where you create green space so that the water that falls from the sky can be absorbed as groundwater as opposed to running off down concrete or asphalt-paved streets.
A lot of it has to do with kind of making a city more of a sponge than a barrier to water. Isn't that right?
Well, you're exactly right. Some of the issues that Houston is confronting now, the Dutch have confronted too, in that the initial reaction is always to fight the water, to channel it away, to pump it away. And the Dutch have learned, certainly over the last 30 or 40 years, and our work in New Orleans and New York, post-Sandy and Norfolk and other places, show that you have to actually create a more resilient system so that the ground and the grass and your natural environments become the place where water naturally gets stored, as opposed to having it, again, channeled on concrete-paved streets where it can't drain anywhere, and thus you get backup flooding.
Isn't there a limit to what coastal cities, whether in the U.S. or elsewhere, can do to prepare? I mean, at a certain point, we don't know what's going to happen. Can a city truly be prepared?
So let's be perfectly clear here. I don't think there's any city in the world that could have dealt with 51 or 52 inches of rain in a matter of 72, 80 hours. There would be flooding no matter what. The issue is, how long is it going to take Houston to recover from this? Its economy, its people, its landscape, what impact will this have? So yes, Harvey may be an outlier at the end of the bell curve, but it is quite clear for Houston and for New Orleans and for other U.S. coastal cities, certainly those cities need to be thinking more long-term. And you don't have to think about protecting yourself against the 1 in 10,000-year flood or the 1 in 5,000-year flood, which are some of the standards are set in the Netherlands, but those are different weather conditions. But you do need to think about how to make it so that you can recover from a storm like this, not 5 years later or 3 years later or 10 years later, as was often the case, which you saw in New Orleans, but within, 6 months or 2 months.
Is a city like Houston, given how it's developed and how it's built and where it is and everything else, is it viable in the long run?
I don't think anyone, knows the answer to that question. Again, we don't know what the rate of sea level rise is going to be. We don't know what investments the city of Houston may make. Parts of the Netherlands are 21, 22 feet below sea level, but with their investments in infrastructure and sound water management and coastal barriers and urban water management practices and green infrastructure, they feel very confident that they are going to be able to maintain living well in that landscape for the next 100 or 200 years. I think our current time frame in the U.S., we plan 5-10 years down the road. And for water management, you want to look at much longer and see what's needed to stay there. And there are 6 million people in that region. The rest of the U.S. depends upon Houston for its petrochemical output and for a bunch of other things. Asking whether it's worth spending $20 billion or $30 billion to protect a multi-hundred billion dollar city, there's an easy answer to that question.
Dale Morris works for the Dutch Embassy in Washington on water management issues. Let's take a closer look now at one district in Houston. It's called the East End, and it's home to two of the city's oldest Hispanic neighborhoods and a variety of family-owned businesses. Among them is a well-loved bakery called El Bolillo. It serves traditional Mexican breads and sweets, including pan dulce and tres leches cakes. This past weekend, when Hurricane Harvey struck, 3 members of the bakery's staff were trapped in the store for 2 days with 4,000 pounds of flour. So as the rain poured down outside, the trapped bakers got to work inside. Jorge Agundis, the kitchen manager, says once the rain started, it didn't take long for the water to rise outside.
Like in 10 or 15 minutes, really quick.
And by the time his night shift was over, roads were impassable. There was no way he could get home to his wife and 3 children. The freeway to his family's trailer park outside Houston was underwater. That's all Jorge says he could think about.
I'm thinking my family because they are in the house. And me in a bakery. I'm worried for my family. Because my sons call me, hey, daddy, where you at?
So with time on their hands and worry in their hearts, Jorge and his colleagues just started baking, and they didn't stop.
And we make a bread for the, make a donation for the old Houston, the old city. We put them in cases, and the police came in to pick it up.
City officials collected more than 1,000 items from the bakers. Meanwhile, bakery owner Kirk Michaelis had been trying to reach his employees.
Yeah, I was not able to get to them for, like I say, for 2 days. I tried. I got stopped about halfway here on Sunday, and they turned me around. But Monday was able to make it here, and when I got here, they had all the bread boxed up, and we made a few phone calls, and the vehicles that were able to get here, a lot of police cars came, but those big Suburbans, and we just loaded them up and sent it out around the city, whoever would come get it.
Were you surprised to arrive Monday morning and see how much they'd accomplished during the storm?
I was amazed. All the racks were full with bread just stacked to the ceiling, and they didn't have to say anything. We just kind of looked at each other and smiled, and we knew that we had to do something with it.
You have several branches of El Bolillo. It sounds like all of them are back up and running. Were you surprised at how dedicated your employees were?
It really just blew me away. And what Jorge said was, well, I couldn't think about my family because it was killing me. He had some small children, and they were in a trailer up around 249 area, and he was afraid it was going to float away. And he was really worried about it. So he just immersed himself into baking.
How did his family make out?
The water got about 6 inches from coming in, but it didn't, and the trailer held, They did really well, and he hasn't been able to see him yet, hadn't been able to go home. It's really flooded around that area. We're going to try to get him home today.
That's amazing. So how many days has he been at the bakery?
He was here for 2 days with the guys, then he spent 2 days at my home. I brought all the bakers and the people that couldn't get home to my house, and I think it's been 4 days. 4 días, he said, yeah, it's been 4 days since he's seen his family. So I know it'll be excited. I have a friend on that side of town that has an airboat. And if we can't get him there by car, we'll get the airboat in and get his family. And they're more than welcome to come and stay with me, too.
Jorge Agundis is the kitchen manager, and Kirk Michaelis is the owner at Houston's El Bolillo Bakery. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. God bless.
Thank you, ma'am. You have a blessed day. Really appreciate all y'all putting this out and helping the people of Houston very much.
From Houston to another city that's seen unprecedented rainfall of late, Mumbai, India. The monsoon season has caused massive flooding this year. I'm talking waist-deep water on the streets and traffic at a standstill. Samir Hashmi is a BBC reporter in Mumbai. Samir, it sounds like the water is starting to recede in some places, but what did you see when the flooding was at its peak? Give us a kind of vivid picture of what it was like.
Tuesday was something really unexpected because the weather department had not predicted this sort of rain during the morning hours. Usually Mumbai, it's very normal to have heavy rains or heavy showers for a couple of hours, and then the showers die down and people move on with normal life. But yesterday, on Tuesday, when the rain started at 10 a.m., it went on relentlessly for about 6 to 7 hours, and it reached a point where water levels started rising, traffic started to get halt, people found it difficult to move from one place to another, and the train service stopped. In Mumbai, the local train service is called the lifeline of Mumbai because every day more than 6 million people travel on that out of 20 million people. So if that stops, it really brings the city to a standstill. So you found people on the roads trying to get onto the train, which is not working. People stopped their cars midway, parked it on the pavement and started walking because there was so much flooding. And I spoke to a lot of people who were actually on the streets for 8 to 9 hours and they couldn't reach home. Many decided to stay back in office because they thought that's going to be a safer option. And this was the highest rainfall which Mumbai has seen in more than 10 years in a single day.
Mumbai is just this huge megacity built on a peninsula that's largely a floodplain with lots of landfill. So it's really prone to floods. What makes this year different?
Mumbai, if you compare it to other cities across the globe, it has the second highest density as far as the population goes. And that puts more pressure not on just roads and railways, but even the sewage system, the drainage system. And the local authorities finds it difficult to keep repairing it and upgrading it. The other problem is that even though Mumbai is a metropolis with 20 million people, there are a lot of people who are poor and stay in slums. In fact, Mumbai has the largest slum in Asia, which is called Dharavi. Now, these people build their houses on old drainage. And what happens is that these areas are more prone to flooding because they don't have proper sewage in place or a drainage system in place, which puts more pressure when a situation like this arises.
Now, there's a lot of hand-wringing in Houston. As you know, there's a lot of flooding there. And a lot of people are saying the design of the city is just wrong. The design of the city is really contributing to flooding. Is that kind of discussion, does that go on in Mumbai when these kind of floods happen?
I think the basic conversation in Mumbai, whenever something like this happens, is that we don't have the basic infrastructure in place. It's not about the design, it's just the basic infrastructure. There is too much encroachment that happens. Land that should be used for building advanced water systems or underground drainage system is actually encroached by people who have no homes to stay in. And they end up building illegal houses on that land in the form of slums. So more than design, I think Mumbai is still stuck, you know, as far as the basics are concerned.
Let's get back to just the weather report. What's it looking like for the next couple of days?
The local weather department has predicted that there could be more rain in the next 24 hours. But today there was sunlight and the water has drained out. So that's really eased the pressure. But everyone's on standby. The local authorities are just waiting and watching. Today, in fact, the government had announced a holiday, a public holiday, due to which all schools, colleges, offices were shut. Tomorrow, people are going to get back to work. And I think everyone's going to try to gauge how the weather is looking, because given what happened on Tuesday, I think many people would be ready to step out of their houses if it starts to rain.
Samir Hashmi is a BBC reporter in Mumbai. Samir, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, don't even think about playing China's national anthem on a harmonica. This is The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. There are some people who grow up thinking they're one thing. Then they go out in the world and discover that other people think they're something else. Yes, we're talking about identity, a real buzzword these days. People's feelings about their identities are changing in the Trump era, and that's something The World's Rupa Shenoy has been looking at all summer. Today, she has the story of a Muslim convert struggling to understand her own white privilege.
The way Amanda Gormley describes her hometown, it sounds like Leave It to Beaver or It's a Wonderful Life. Everyone knew each other and looked out for each other, and everyone was white.
Literally, like, there was a little girl that sent her grandma a postcard and didn't know her address, so she wrote Grandma, Elbridge, New York, and it, like, showed up at the grandma's house because everyone knows each other and they knew who the grandma's birthday was.
As an adult, Amanda experiences a very different America. She married a black man, converted to Islam, started wearing a hijab, and has mixed-race kids. We're sitting in her backyard in Tucson. Everyone else is inside. She invited me over for a dinner with a bunch of other Tucson women who originally met through Pantsuit Nation, the big Facebook group that supported Hillary Clinton that got some flack from critics. They said its white feminist voices drowned out those of women of color. The morning after the election, Amanda saw she was tagged on a new Tucson Pantsuit Nation Facebook page. A woman had posted an offer to accompany Muslim women who didn't feel safe in public. Lots of people responded to also volunteer. It kind of pissed Amanda off a little. She didn't want people to think of Muslim women as victims.
We've been dealing with the issue of hate crimes for a long time. We've been dealing with people staring at us and giving us weird looks and feeling a little bit out of place for a really long time. And we know how to handle that pretty well.
Then she realized there was another dynamic at play. In a meeting at her mosque, fellow Muslims said they felt like they had to prove they weren't some kind of terrorist threat. They were doing things like taking cookies to neighbors and introducing themselves.
To hear them talking about their struggle to try to prove to their neighbors that they're good people that don't want to hurt anyone was really hurtful. And it just made me start to feel so angry and just feel like it is not our burden to carry this. It's not our job to teach other people who we are, what we believe in, and that we don't want to hurt them. That should be the assumption.
So that was her attitude for a while, a little defiant. But things seemed to get worse fast. Lynn Harani, another dinner guest tonight, remembers getting a call from a young Muslim woman who'd woken up to find herself in the desert. The last thing she remembered was getting a drink with friends.
And she had her drink drugged. She was taken and she was basically beaten and raped and left at the side of the road. And when we picked her up, she just kept saying, they're going to kill all the Muslims and they hate us and... That for me was a shock.
Amanda Gormley started imagining frightening scenarios, like people showing up at her front door to take her kids. Things like that felt possible now. And suddenly taking cookies to the neighbors seemed like a pretty good idea. But Amanda wanted to do something more meaningful. She messaged two other members of the new Tucson Pantsuit Nation group, Emily Joseph, a local scientist who'd put up that original post offering to escort Muslim women, and Esther Brilliant, a local county public defender. Both are from social justice-minded Jewish families. Esther says, until the election, she thought she understood the extent of American racism.
Now that I'm saying that out loud, it's super naive. But, I mean, Barack Obama was president, you know what I mean? Like, I thought things were okay.
The three of them agreed to meet at Emily's house. They told me about it inside at the dinner party.
I've never cleaned my house that quickly in my life. None of us had any idea what we were doing.
I think Amanda kind of did.
Amanda did.
Amanda had, like, agendas written up for meetings and things like that when I was just like, I don't know, we'll just go and we'll talk about it. And she's like, that's going to be a nightmare. You don't know what you're doing, in a very nice way.
Their next meeting, with a bigger group, still had some flaws. There were too many white people, Esther says.
So we kind of had to examine that and where that came from and take a look at, like, how we were going to not be awful, I guess.
The three of them, Amanda, Emily, and Esther, agreed the Tucson Pantsuit Nation chapter should have a basic philosophy to amplify unheard voices and get people to listen to each other. That middle path really made sense to Amanda as she tried to navigate being both a white woman with privilege and a member of the Muslim community whose identity seemed a lot more dangerous in the Trump era.
I'm trying to find a way to be more for my community and also at the same time be less because I don't want to take up space that other people maybe could be occupying and telling their story.
So they organized dinners and moderated difficult discussions about all kinds of things. When Trump announced his travel ban, the Tucson Pantsuit Nation group raised thousands of dollars for the ACLU. By the time summer started, their group had 5,000 members. They were on a roll. Emily and Esther felt like they were finally getting activism right. Amanda felt safer. They plan to go even bigger and bought the site pntucson.org for Pantsuit Nation Tucson. Then a funny thing happened. The National Pantsuit Nation group seemed to shift in a less political direction. The Tucson women decided that wasn't good enough for them. This is Esther.
They wanted to be just storytelling, and we weren't about that. Politics is life. Like, these decisions are affecting every aspect of our lives.
Esther, Emily, and Amanda decided to break away from the National Pantsuit Nation group, hoping they could still keep their momentum going. They brainstormed for a new name that preferably started with a P and an N, since they'd already bought a site with those letters.
So Project Nexus came out of that struggle, but we think it's a good fit.
Project Nexus conveys what they hope to continue building, a connected group of diverse people who recognize their own privilege, listen to each other, and look out for each other. Just like people did back in Amanda's hometown in New York. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
We've got just enough time for one more story before the break. Turns out Americans aren't the only ones who take their national anthem very seriously. China does, too. So seriously, in fact, that Beijing is considering a law which would make disrespecting the Chinese anthem a crime. My BBC colleague John Sudworth has the story.
"Arise, ye who refuse to be slaves," go the lyrics and, it might now be added, sing in tune. China's national parliament says it wants to encourage the public performance of the March of the Volunteers, but only at formal events like political gatherings or sports competitions, and only if it's done in a respectful manner. It's not clear exactly what will be deemed offensive and whether online renditions will be policed, but serious offences such as maliciously altering lyrics will be punishable with up to 15 days' detention. President Xi Jinping has made a resurgent brand of nationalism a cornerstone of his first 5 years in office, along with a growing intolerance of dissent. The new law is an attempt to have everyone, quite literally, singing from the same hymn sheet.
I don't know. I thought that harmonica version was pretty good. That report from the BBC's John Sudworth.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, an Afghan refugee in Turkey looks for his wife and kids almost 2 years after they went missing in the Mediterranean. This volunteer is trying to help him navigate the Turkish bureaucracy.
It's really, really confusing because this is always what happens. Every person sends us to a different place.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. There are fewer and fewer heroes left from World War II. Today, we remember a French woman who was definitely one of those heroes. She was a spy named Jeanne Rousseau de Clarin, and she passed away last week, aged 98. Rousseau stole key secrets from the Nazis, including details of many secret weapons. At a CIA awards ceremony in 1993, then Director of Central Intelligence James Woolsey said the information she gathered saved thousands of lives. The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, is here to tell us more. So, Chris, who was this woman?
Well, she was a very talented young linguist. Her family was from Brittany in the west of France. And the thing that really strikes you, first of all, is just how young she was. She was just turned 21 when the Germans took over her country in 1940, when she began her career as a spy.
How did she become a spy?
Well, it was almost by accident. Given her language skills, she was fluent in German. She became an interpreter for the Germans out there in Western France, where the Germans were planning to invade Britain. And when a friend in the resistance asked her to share the information she was overhearing and things she was seeing, she said, of course.
It sounds like at first she was using her superb German language skills as an interpreter, but later she then got into the belly of the beast in terms of learning about these weapons. How did that happen?
Well, her forte was her language skills. Yes, she definitely was working for the Germans in the Western France before she was caught there, arrested and released for lack of information. And then she went to Paris and assumed a new identity, again, working as an interpreter for something like the French Chamber of Commerce. So she was providing language skills between the Germans who wanted, you know, goods and services and French businessmen who were trying to sell them. So she was getting a lot of information about different projects that the Germans were up to. And she happened to run into, this is how she saved thousands of lives. She ran into a bunch of German officers and scientists who were working on a top secret rocket and missile programs. Listeners may have heard of the V1 and V2 rockets. But her information on that was so good that it convinced British intelligence of the seriousness of their plans. And her information on where they were producing and testing these rockets allowed the Brits to bomb that facility and set back the German program by months. It's still discussed today as a masterpiece of intelligence work.
And I understand one reason she was so effective is that she had a photographic memory. So she wasn't a scientist or rocket scientist.
No, absolutely. I guess there's so many qualities to her that are worth mentioning. First was just her charm. She never used her body like, you know, the spies of fiction to try and get information. And then she had this incredible, like, think on your feet smarts. Whenever she was confronted with a situation, she would instantly create a cover story. And then she would affect this kind of innocence and naivete. She never really spoke about her exploits, but she did give one extended interview to David Ignatius of the Washington Post back in the 90s. And she told him, "I teased them, I taunted them, I looked at them wide-eyed and said, that can't be true." And she kept saying this until one officer just showed her documents and diagrams to prove what he was saying was actually true. She was no scientist, but as you say, she was blessed with this photographic memory.
I read that she wondered, she gathered this intelligence, she had no hesitation about doing it, but she was then privately wondering, is anybody going to get this information? And then it turns out that within 48 hours, it was on Churchill's desk.
Right. I mean, Churchill had to be convinced by the young British analyst on the other end, on the receiving end, who actually was decorated by Wolsey at the same ceremony in 1993 by the director of the CIA. And I think, every spy has got to operate in that kind of environment. You don't know if anybody's actually listening to what you're telling them. And that speaks to the courage of the people doing this kind of work. And again, she told David Ignatius something that is really striking to anybody today. You know, he said, "Well, why did you do it?" And she says, "I don't understand the question. There wasn't a choice. It was what you did." You know, it was just what he calls it, just a reflex, the heroic reflex. She chose to actually do something. She didn't even question it when millions of people chose to do nothing.
And she saved thousands of lives. She also paid a heavy price. I mean, once she was caught, she spent time in three different concentration camps. How did she spend the rest of her life?
Well, one of the first things she did was to marry a fellow inmate from the camp, the Vicomte de Clarens. But she didn't want to let her language skills go to waste. So she became an interpreter for the United Nations and later a campaigner for Amnesty International. She got many decorations from France and the US after the war, but she never really spoke of her exploits. David Ignatius of the Post was one of the few people to ever actually draw out the full story from her. And one of the quotes that he cites was, "What I did was so little. Others did so much more. I was one small stone." And so the humility as well, I think, is another outstanding feature of Jeanne Rousseau.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, talking about the amazing World War II spy, Jeanne Rousseau de Clarens, who died last week at the age of 98. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome, Carol.
The Mediterranean is a deadly place for refugees. Just this year, more than 2,000 people have died trying to cross that stretch of water. Some bodies are recovered and do end up being identified, but hundreds remain missing or are just a number on a grave. Survivors are left with the tough task of trying to find those they've lost. This is the story of one Afghan man in Turkey who's determined to keep searching for his family, dead or alive. Here's Fariba Nawa in Istanbul.
I'm on a ferry with Mushtaba Haydar, and he tells me the story of how he lost his wife and two of his children. On October 16, 2015, Haydar and his wife and kids boarded a smuggler's boat in Turkey headed for Greece. It was supposed to be a 20-minute ride to Lesbos, but the boat got lost.
Suddenly, a big wave crashed the boat. The boat split it in half. In a second, the boat get under the water.
Haider tried to grab a hold of his family.
I was trying to catch my daughter, my wife. I tried a lot, but as far as the wave was too fast, too big, so I couldn't find them. It was a really bad night.
And that was the last time he saw them. His wife, his daughter, and youngest son are still missing. Only his son Bahram survived. He's now 8. But Haider continues to search for his family, and he's enlisted the help of Stella Chiarelli. She's a volunteer with United Rescues, a group that tries to find missing refugees. It's not going well. Haider and Chiarelli are taking the ferry to Bursa, near where the boat sank in 2015. They're going to the morgue there, and not for the first time. In the past, they went to see if any bodies had washed up. This time, they're trying to find out how Haider can donate DNA to help identify unclaimed remains. It's surprisingly difficult. When Turkey's Coast Guard recovers a body, they take it to the nearest morgue. A DNA sample is collected, and it's stored for 5 years. If a relative identifies a body, they can then give a DNA sample. And if there's a match, they can claim the body. But at this point, there's no central DNA bank for matching relatives with unclaimed remains. 3 hours later, we arrive in Bursa. When we go to the morgue, 2 attendants ask me to leave. Stella Chiarelli explains.
They are having some problems with the fact that there is a journalist here. They said that if you can leave the room, they can give me more information.
I leave, but 10 minutes later, Haider and Chiarelli come out, looking frustrated. Haider says they showed him a website with images of unidentified bodies that have washed up in the past 2 years, but he doesn't recognize anyone in the pictures. What about giving a DNA sample?
It's really, really confusing because in the district attorney in Istanbul, they told us to go to the district attorney where the autopsy was made. But now we came where the autopsy is made and they told us no, that to go to the attorney's office in the district where the person was found. So this is always what happens. Every person sends us to a different place.
We go to a cafe near the morgue and Chiarelli calls the Bursa district attorney's office.
Sadece oraya mı gelirsem? Yani telefondan hiçbir...
They tell her to go to the courthouse. But when we get there, we're told no one can help. No one seems to know where Haider can give a DNA sample. We board the ferry empty-handed. Back in Istanbul, I check in with Nadir Erican, a forensics expert at the Istanbul University Faculty of Medicine. He confirms there's no centralized DNA bank for identifying missing people.
Havuz yok şu anda. DNA havuzu yok. Yani aslında olması gereken...
We have thousands of DNA samples. It's kind of impossible to match everything without a national bank. Unless a person can point to a specific body and say, this is my relative, there's no process to do the test.
And Haider doesn't have a body. So he keeps checking the missing person's website, and he continues to hope that he'll still find his wife and children alive somewhere, perhaps in a refugee detention camp somewhere near Turkey. But it's been almost 2 years, and Haider says he has to think about his son Bahram, the one who survived. Bahram goes to a Turkish school and speaks better Turkish now than his native language, Farsi Dari.
We left Afghanistan because there was war and fighting. I'm happy here.
Haider hopes eventually they can go to the United States. He's applied for a special immigrant visa to the U.S. for people who have worked with the U.S. military, like he did in Afghanistan. But that would probably mean giving up his search. For the world, Feribanawa, Istanbul.
A president under investigation for corruption. A president who then tried to interfere with that investigation by getting rid of the prosecutor. No, not in Washington. The story takes place in Guatemala. Anna Catherine Brigida is a reporter in Guatemala City. Anna Catherine, who is the president?
So the president is Jimmy Morales. He's a former comedian, and he rose to the presidency in 2015 on an anti-corruption ticket. So his slogan was, not corrupt and not a thief.
So he's a former comedian, runs on an anti-corruption platform, and now he's accused of corruption?
Yes, that's basically it.
And what's he specifically accused of?
So basically, there's about $800,000 of financing for the campaign that is unaccounted for, so meaning they haven't been able to show where exactly that money comes from. And so on Friday, the Attorney General and the Anti-Corruption Committee called CSIG, which is backed by the UN, announced that they are investigating Jimmy Morales for that, and that they were asking for Congress to strip Jimmy Morales of his immunity so that they could further investigate him.
And what happened after the commission tried to strip him of immunity?
So on Friday, Jimmy Morales was in New York speaking to the head of the UN. And then when he came back on Sunday, he announced over his Facebook page that he was declaring the head of CSIG, Ivan Velasquez, as a persona non grata in Guatemala, which basically means that he was saying that he's no longer welcome in the country because he's not Guatemalan. He's from Colombia. And so that means that he could be deported from the country.
So what happens now? I mean, can the charges of corruption go forward against the president?
So after Jimmy Morales made that announcement to try to kick out Ivan Velasquez, the Guatemalan Constitutional Court declared that basically he can't be thrown out of the country, and they invalidated what Jimmy Morales said.
So the president is effectively being overruled. What are the next steps here? I mean, could the president, Jimmy Morales, be impeached?
Yeah, right now it's really up to Congress. So they can vote to impeach him, and it's not clear when they will do that. But it's really up to them where things will be going from here.
What's the reaction been in Guatemala to these unusual events?
There's been huge protests. On Saturday, there was a huge protest. Tens of thousands of people went out into Guatemala's central plaza to protest. And so people are definitely making their voice heard. I think most people believe that the president has done something in terms of corruption. Maybe people are not exactly sure what he's done, or, you know, how far it goes, if it could be even something more than the illegal campaign financing. But it definitely, you know, most people find it fishy that he wanted to throw out the person who was investigating him.
You mentioned that thousands of Guatemalans took to the streets to protest against the president. Is this spirit of activism new in Guatemala?
So Guatemala has actually gone through a very similar process in 2015. There was a huge protest movement, and there were tens of thousands of people who went out every Saturday to Guatemala Central Plaza to demand the resignation of their former president, Otto Perez Molina, who is now in jail facing corruption charges. But I would say before that, you know, it was a very uncommon thing in Guatemala. Guatemala experienced a long and brutal civil war that ended in 1996. And so up until 2015, there wasn't really a culture of social activism and of people going out into the streets to have their voices heard, because, you know, many people were used to growing up in a time of military repression during the civil war. So the protests in 2015 were really, you know, something new to Guatemala, but now we're seeing that people are ready once again to have their voice be heard.
Anna Catherine Brigida is a reporter in Guatemala City. Thanks, Anna Catherine.
Thank you.
There are plenty of flashpoints these days between the European Union and one of its member states, Poland. But this latest one might be a bit unexpected. Poland's Białowieża Forest is one of Europe's last primeval landscapes. It's a UN World Heritage Site, and it's home to rare animals and untouched ancient habitats. And right now, it's also home to a big increase in logging. A European court has ordered Poland to stop cutting trees there, to which Poland has basically replied, "Mind your own business." Our BBC colleague Charlotte Pament has this report on the fight over the forest.
Heavy-duty harvesters tear down trees in Białowieża Forest. The Polish government says it's in the interests of public safety. Last year, Warsaw ramped up logging in order, it said, to tackle a bark beetle infestation. Environmentalists called it a cover for commercial logging. I'm walking through Białowieża Forest with an ecologist who works in the area.
I'm Rafał Kowalczyk. I'm head of the Momo Research Institute, Polish Academy of Sciences.
What is the bark beetle infestation?
Bark beetles are occurring in this forest every few years, and this is one of the natural processes which is shaping the forest. The foresters use these bark beetles, which are killing some proportion of the trees, as a reason for logging the trees. One of the most valuable forests in Europe is being destroyed.
Outside the National Parliament in Warsaw, I meet Dominik Tarczynski, a member of the governing Law and Justice Party.
2 years ago, when we were elected, we found out that Białowieża is in such a terrible shape, and we had to react. We had to cut some of the trees.
But most scientists, especially those who've worked in the forest for decades, believe that logging is the wrong way to go about it.
And I'm really sad to say that many of NGOs is protesting now in Białowieża are leftist, political connected people paid by someone who wants to make business on it.
Such is a mistrust on both sides that there are some who have taken matters into their own hands.
Next action.
I'm sitting in a wooden barn, which is the kind of makeshift HQ of Camp for the Forest, which is a group of activists who are trying to peacefully intervene in the logging.
Hi, my name is Asha. Sometimes it feels like a fairy tale or something, because we're up against really evil Minister of Environment. And that sounds so ridiculous at itself, like the guy who is a Minister of Environment and saving the environment is the guy who is killing it.
The Minister Asher is talking about is Jan Sisko. We repeatedly asked to speak to him, but he refused to be interviewed. Under his leadership, logging has increased threefold, but state foresters insist it's done to save Białowieża. One thing all sides agree on is that this fairy tale forest is valuable.
This is the world heritage. It's not only Polish thing. It's our world's heritage. So it's 12,000-year-old forest. And just, you know what, it's summer, it's warm, it's beautiful. Come and see it for yourself.
A Polish activist named Asha, ending that report from the BBC's Charlotte Pament. We've got some pretty smooth grooves to end the show with today. When you think of Somalia now, you probably think of war and conflict. But back in the 1970s and 80s, things were different. It was a time of peace and a golden age for Somali music. Traditional styles were fused with sounds from India and even disco and reggae. Some of this music was recently rediscovered. A hoard of lost tapes was found hidden under the floor of a Somali radio station in the city of Hargeisa. They'd been hidden because of airstrikes. Now the tracks have been reissued in a new album called Sweet as Broken Dates. My colleague Yasmin Ahmed is a British Somali who works for the BBC Somali service. She's been digging into the music.
The reason the album has come out now is because the producer, Vic Sahoni, was in Hargeisa for 2 years researching about Somali music and why Somali music back in the 70s and 80s sounded so bizarre to him. There was a mix of everything within Somali music, and so he wanted to know why. And he happened to be in Hargeisa, and he met, well, a former employee of Radio Hargeisa, and he told him how during airstrikes, some of the employees of Radio Hargeisa were hiding some of these archives, the cassette tapes, under the ground. There were about 10,000 archive tapes, and he was going through them. A mix of rock, jazz, a bit of reggae. Because of films like Captain Philip and The Black Hawk Down, we have this image of anarchy, chaos, poverty, war, and we associate it to Somalia. And, you know, during the 60s, 70s and 80s, you know, Somali music was flourishing. It was influenced by the Indian traders. It was influenced by the Brits. So, for instance, you can even hear a bit of British rock towards the end. And so the mesh of this sound creates a remarkable hybrid sound of music. It's the kind of music that my parents would listen to, and it's the kind of music the older generation would listen to. It's not necessarily the kind of music we would listen to. And so it's played in Somalia, and it's quite popular in Somalia, but in the Western world, it's not that popular. With Somali music, because it's so poetic, you need to have it written down for you to understand exactly what they're saying. A lot of musicians say the same thing. They say, we're not musicians, we are poets. And so some of the words they use and some of the phrases they use are very archaic. Imagine listening to Shakespeare and someone's reading a Shakespeare play to you. You wouldn't understand it the first time they sing it to you. You need to have it written down and analyse it and read it. And that's why that era was very different to the music that's produced now. Now there are younger generations of Somalis making music, and they are trying to restore the arts. They're trying to restore that golden era, and the older musicians are trying to help them. But because this modernization of Somali music has happened, some of the music stars from the 70s and 80s believe that that era can never be restored. So they're trying their best, but all odds are against them. So this is Romeo and Juliet, Qais iyo Leyla in Somali. And the reason why I like this is because of the different influences and the different instruments that you can hear, and also the reggae beats.
My BBC colleague Yasmin Ahmed introducing new music from the album of Lost Somali Tunes called Sweet as Broken Dates. And that's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.